This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Friday, April 12th. The Liberal government lays out its full plan to solve the housing crisis. Coming up, Housing Minister Sean Fraser on when Canadians can expect to feel an impact. Meanwhile, some provinces are pushing back. We'll ask Alberta Premier Danielle Smith why she's threatening to block municipalities from cutting their own deals with Ottawa. And on carbon pricing, is the Liberal government losing a key ally? The Power Panel is here to debate a possible shift from the NDP. We begin with the federal Liberals and their pre-budget blitz on housing. So far, they've announced billions of dollars in new spending and loans aimed at targeting home and rental construction. Today, they promised those measures would lead to 3.9 million new homes by 2031. The Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation said it would take 3.5 million homes to make them affordable again. But the federal government admits it can't solve the housing crunch alone, and this plan is already facing opposition from some provinces. Sean Fraser, the Minister of Housing, Infrastructure and Communities, joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So you have a strategy that you think can more or less solve the gap in Canada's housing supply, but the country may not have the workers and you may not have all of the provinces on board. So how do you overcome those two big things to implement this?
Well, look, you went right to the two biggest challenges. I think we're going to have a series of policies that's going to allow us to create a financial equation that will get Canada building. I think we can create incentives that will change the way that cities build homes, but we can't do it alone. We need provinces to come along with us. We're going to put federal money on the table to incentivize the kind of changes that lay within provincial jurisdiction to help them contribute solutions. And on the second question around the workforce, we're going to put serious investments behind efforts to train the Canadian home building workforce, including foreign credential recognition, including growing the domestic Canadian workforce, and also new investments that will help change the way that we build homes to incentivize more home building in factory settings that allow you to do more year-round construction, multiple shifts per day, and can prove to be twice as fast when it comes to building the kinds of homes that we need as compared to traditional construction methods. This is a lot of work ahead, but I believe we can get it done.
Okay, I want to walk through a couple of those things in order and then get into the specifics of the policies you've laid out. But let's start with the provinces, if we can, Premier. The conditions that you've laid on the table for the money coming in this budget, Ontario has said they won't go with that. I know you can go to the municipalities there, but Alberta is going to pass legislation, it seems, that would stop you from going to the municipalities. So there is an increased pushback on this. Even though there were demands for the federal government to take action on housing, provinces are now asserting their jurisdiction. Can money alone solve that friction?
Well, there's no question we're going to need to see political will, not just from the federal government, which I would suggest we've certainly demonstrated today, but from provincial governments. We do want to work with provinces, as the plan has actually primarily contemplates deals with provinces. Should they not demonstrate a willingness to implement the kinds of measures that we believe are required to solve the housing crisis, we'll seek to work directly with cities. Now, if they want to add layers of bureaucracy that would slow the process down, then they're free to do that, but it's going to be counterproductive. But we're going to start by working with the most ambitious provinces, the most ambitious cities to get the job done. I'm going to take phone calls. I'm going to have meetings with my provincial and territorial counterparts. We want to be a good partner and move forward in good faith. But if they dig in and insist that they don't want to implement the very real solutions that we know will help increase the pace of home building in this country, then I think their constituents are going to have something to say for it. Because everywhere I go in Canada, people want governments to solve the housing crisis, not to just talk about it.
So it sounds like your message to them is step up or lose out. That if you make it harder, we'll go to the province next door and do a deal with them.
Look, there's. I want to preserve the ability to have good faith conversations, but we are absolutely asking provinces to step up. But we're not just asking them. We're putting money on the table to incentivize them to do things that they could already do for free that are within their jurisdictions. So my sincere hope is that they're going to implement the kinds of policy reforms and potentially match some of our funding contributions to build more infrastructure, to build more homes, so we can actually solve the housing crisis. But should they not demonstrate the political will to get the job done, then we're going to find ways to work directly with communities wherever possible.
Okay, on the workforce challenges, Minister, I know you say you're going to spend money on training, but there aren't enough workers right now in the construction industry to build at the pace that is required. And Kevin Lee from the Canadian Home Builders Association was on the show last night, and he's warning that 1 in 5, 20% of the workforce they have right now is going to retire over this next critical decade. So how do you scale up a workforce at the pace that is required to meet these targets you've now set?
Well, first of all, let me take an opportunity to thank Kevin. He's provided invaluable advice that helped to lead to some of the policies that we're rolling out today that we believe is going to help scale home building production in this country. He's absolutely right. This is a significant potential bottleneck to the success of the initiative, but we believe we can clear the hurdles before us. It's going to take serious incentives to first grow the Canadian home building workforce with dedicated funds for training people in the skilled trades, including growing awareness of the career opportunities for young people to make a good living in the trades. These are good paying jobs that we're going to help incentivize by getting more people into the programs. Now, we're also going to work to scale up foreign credential recognition because there are people in Canada now who have the skills we need but don't have the formal qualifications to leverage those skills to the potential that we think Canada can actually benefit from. But even when we grow the workforce through a mix of training, skills recognition, and targeted immigration programs, we also need to change the way that Canada builds homes. We have an opportunity to scale home building factories that exist today and attract more investment that again will create good paying jobs for Canadians and provide a solution to the housing crisis by building at a far greater pace. There's a number of elements to that plan, including direct investment that will benefit factories, but there's also new programs like the Home Design Catalog that will help create economies of scale that we believe will help increase the rate of home building when we align design, manufacture, municipal approval, and financing rules to build certain kinds of homes. We believe we can create more cost-effective, labor-efficient designs that will be produced at a higher pace than is currently possible in the Canadian economy today.
So you're putting options and you're putting incentives on the table, but you're also putting federal land on the table here. You're talking not selling the land to be turned into housing, but to lease it, I guess, long-term, decades-long leases for people to avoid that capital recovery, I guess, being part of the cost. What sort of buildings are we talking about here, Minister? Are we talking about office space in downtown cores that maybe aren't used as people work from home? Are we talking surplus military land? What are we kind of properties are we talking about being turned into housing now?
There's a significant number of different kinds of properties that could play into this. Now, the federal government owns significant numbers of parcels of land right across the country. Some of them aren't great for home building. Some of them are perfect for home building. Now, some of those possibly could still be disposed if the federal government doesn't have an interest in maintaining them. But we have a mix of different properties, some which don't have anything on them today, some of them which may have a building that's not mutually exclusive to the possibility of home building. It could be vacant offices in Ottawa. It also could be space for new builds that are on a property that one building exists that doesn't take up the entire space. It could be on bare land that may exist today that we could lease out for the purpose of building a housing development that could be subject to a lease over the life cycle of the entire building. The advantage is that you take the cost of the land out of the input when a builder is actually looking at whether the math is going to work. This is going to reduce the cost of construction, but it also affords the opportunity to pass on those savings to the people who live in the land, live in the homes on the land, because the federal government making that contribution will be able to negotiate terms of the lease that would require a certain level of affordability to ensure that we're getting the good return on investment that reduces the cost of living for Canadians. This is a sea change in the way that we want to leverage federal lands, but my view is where there's a public interest in the public lands, those lands should remain public, and we have an opportunity to dramatically scale home building on public lands in a way that will protect the level of affordability that Canadians will enjoy by reducing the cost of construction and negotiating with builders in exchange for access to those properties.
You've got a target of almost 4 million homes that you say can be built under this plan if fully adopted and implemented over, the next 7 years. That's 560,000 homes a year. We're nowhere near that kind of scale. So a lot of this has to come together really quickly for this to work. And it's coming at a time, Minister, where the labor shortage is, while you have a plan, it's going to take time to deal with that. It's going to take time to get people into the financial mechanisms you're putting on the table. And it seems like it's going to take some time to get the provinces on board.
Well, the good news is we've already started. You'll recall back not long after my appointment, we made certain changes around tax policy for apartment construction with the removal of the GST, and we saw thousands of new units come online that otherwise would never be built. We also were rolling out the Housing Accelerator Fund, which has now concluded 179 agreements that has fundamentally changed the way that cities and communities build homes in this country by making it easier for people to build homes and reducing the timelines to get an approval. Today represents a series of new measures that are going to dramatically scale up the financial incentives to build, allow more people to take part in the solution by engaging Canadians who may want to get involved in home building, including on their own property, as well as large institutional builders, continuing to make it easier to build in cities and changing the way that we build homes. This is not going to be easy, but nothing worth doing is. We want to solve a major national crisis, and if we don't have the political ambition to set that goal, then we're going to be doomed to fail from the beginning. But we want to succeed. We want to solve the crisis, and I believe we can.
You're calling it a crisis in your own words. We heard the Deputy Prime Minister today speaking about how young people feel the deck is stacked against them. The Prime Minister saying it used to be that the deal was that if you worked hard, that if you got a good job, you would be able to afford a home. And that's not the case anymore. You're aiming this specifically at young people, but you've been the government for going on 9 years, for the better part of a decade right now, and the people who have been in power as this problem has gotten to the point of being a crisis are now telling the people affected by this that they're the people to fix it. I mean, what do you say to people who look at that with a great amount of skepticism that the people who have been in control as it got to this point are the people to fix it?
Look, first of all, skepticism is a healthy thing in a democracy. I'm not asking people to believe in a promise. I'm asking them to believe in a plan. They can read it for themselves and determine whether they think it's going to address their very real concerns that we need to respond to. When we arrived in government, we adopted the National Housing Strategy, but that disproportionately focused on the biggest challenge at the time, was addressing the lack of affordable housing for low-income families in this country, with some additional supports to build more apartments in larger urban centers. As we started to come out of the pandemic, when we saw a lot of the housing supply in this country bought up when interest rates were very low, we saw inflation impact the cost of building with rising prices for material, labor, land, interest, and other aspects of home building, and we suddenly saw a rapid increase in home prices and a lack of availability for people in cities and communities, big and small, across the country. As the landscape changes, so too must our policies change. We are responding to the changing nature of the housing crisis that is not just impacting Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, but even in my hometown in rural Nova Scotia. We need to do everything we can. David, I'm one of the few cabinet ministers who's still in his 30s for at least a few months more. Everybody my age and younger is consumed with this issue. There's few people talking about the dream home they're going to have one day and are worried about whether they can afford the place that they're already living in. We want to create a sense of hope that we can create opportunities for people to own a home one day if they choose, or to find a rent that they can afford. Today's plan charts a path that's going to allow us to get there, so long as other levels of government come along this journey with us.
Well, it just as a final question, Minister, the reviews of the plan from a lot of the people who work in this space, the homelessness and housing advocates we've spoken with, say it's ambitious, possibly achievable, and will deal with a lot of what they have considered to be the problems in this space. You've got about 18 months to the next election at maximum, and this is coming very late at a time of great frustration and anger with your government. I mean, politically, are you worried you just have left this too late as a government for to make a difference in the time you have left and for your political fortunes?
Look, my view is it's always the right time to do the right thing. And as you know, a friend of mine who recently passed away, Brian Mulroney, his voice is in my ear, reminding me not to focus on the headlines that are going to be earned over the next few weeks, but the problems that we're going to solve over the course of the next generation. The reason that we're putting a plan on the table to solve the national housing crisis is because we want to create a sense of hope for the next generation that they can actually find a place to live that they can afford. I don't think that's too much to ask in a country as wealthy as Canada, and the plan that we put on the table today is reasonable, achievable, and ambitious. I think it's the right path forward, and we can solve the housing crisis.
Minister Sean Fraser, always appreciate the time. Thank you, sir.
A pleasure, as always.
The Alberta government is attempting to build a firewall against the federal government, tabling legislation allowing it to block new funding deals between Ottawa and Alberta municipalities and other organizations. Alberta Premier Daniel Smith pointed to housing agreements between the federal government and municipalities as problematic, but Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Ottawa is just doing what it takes to build more housing.
We heard from a cavalcade of premiers saying, see, the federal government needs to step up more, needs to do more. It's trying to get out of the business of housing. The federal government needs to step up and fix this housing crisis that we've seen across the country. So we are. Provinces should be careful what they wish for.
Alberta Premier Daniel Smith is here in Ottawa today, and she joins me now in the studio. Premier, it's good to see you again. Thanks
Hi,
for coming
David.
In. So the Prime Minister and his government have been under pressure to respond on affordability, to respond on housing, to respond on infrastructure. And now that they started rolling out programs, you've responded with this legislation. How does that help Alberta cities and Albertans get ahead?
Well, because we want all Alberta cities and all municipalities to get ahead in the same way that they know how to do cooperative federalism, because they do it with Quebec. Back in November, they announced a $900 million housing accelerator agreement with Quebec. And in fact, in the announcement today, they affirmed that they're going to continue with that kind of cooperative approach with Quebec. They recognize that they have to do things differently in Quebec. And why? Because Quebec passed legislation saying you can't do a workaround. You have to work with us. You can't go directly to municipalities. So we're passing very similar legislation modeled after the Quebec model.
So you want the Quebec treatment, but will you offer the Quebec commitment? Because in that $900 million housing accelerator announcement, Quebec matched the money dollar for dollar, and they got a multiplier effect. The way they've been doing it with cities is just it's federal money in return for zoning changes.
Well, we do have $840 million that we're putting up for affordable housing already over the next 3 years to build 25,000 affordable housing units. And we're working our way through the regulatory process to start finding ways to reduce red tape so that we can do some acceleration. We're putting forward dollars for transportation projects to open up new communities. Those are the kind of things that I think make sense. We want to be able to get these homes built fast. We need to. We're growing like we never have before.
But for decades now, federal governments have been doing deals directly with cities. You know, the gas tax transfer, direct cash transfers help with transit, for example. Why all of a sudden do you feel the need to put a barrier in the way of provincial approval in these agreements?
Well, I look at it as an enhancement, because I can tell you what happened in our province is that on one day when they announced one deal for one city of $175 million, they flew to British Columbia and announced a $2 billion deal that would cover all municipalities. It's just simply not efficient for the federal government to have bilateral deals with all 350 of Alberta municipalities. So it's either going to be a bunch of red tape, a bunch of time, or there's going to be a lot of municipalities left out, and that's not fair.
Not efficient for who? I mean,
not efficient for the federal government.
But relations with your government and the federal government are not good. So if they want to advance their agenda and feel they can talk to the mayors and get a deal more easily than dealing with your government, that's efficient for them, if not for you.
I disagree with the way you've characterized it. We were able to have a health care deal with the federal government over 10 years, as well as four side deals where we could talk about the things that we shared in common. We have had agreements when we fought forest fires. We have had agreements when it comes to investment in key infrastructure in our province from the private sector, Dow Chemical, Heidelberg, we've got Air Products. We have a whole pile of ways that we're working together on an ITC for investment in carbon capture, utilization, and storage. This is why it's so strange that with all of the different tables and working groups that we have, all the history that we have in working collaboratively, why they continue from time to time to make political announcements, announcing areas in our jurisdiction without doing any consultation whatsoever. It's got to stop.
Okay. No, and that is a fair point, that you have worked well together on a number of issues, but on other issues, it has been conflict-ridden, I think is a fair character.
Well, there's conflict when we're at odds on the policy outcome. And what we don't like seeing is that when you're at odds on a policy outcome, then you should come together and try to find a solution. We're trying to get alignment on getting to a carbon neutral status by 2050. They want to accelerate it, and they want to start legislating in areas that are simply not theirs to legislate in under the Constitution. And housing is another example. And let's not forget that one of the things that they want to achieve is net zero housing. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that they have talked about in doing so is not allowing homes to hook up to natural gas, phasing out natural gas appliances. That's not on in our market. Well, if that's what they're trying to do with the workaround, we're not going to let them do that.
But let's zero in on housing, because you followed the political argument in this country for the past year. It's been there's a housing crisis in this country because the federal government hasn't done enough. And now they've started to do a lot of things, and suddenly jurisdiction becomes a big thing when housing isn't their jurisdiction, but they were being pressured and demanded to take action. And the Prime Minister said today the Premier should be careful what they ask for. Are you having a hard time taking yes for an answer?
Well, I would take a yes for an answer if they worked with us the way they did Quebec. They are not calling my housing minister and working collaboratively to come to a solution like they did with Quebec. And we're putting forward legislation where we say that's our expectation. And we'll see how they respond to that. But I don't appreciate them making political decisions, pitting one community against another, pitting rural against urban, leaving out many of our rapidly growing mid-sized communities leaving out our Indigenous partners. I don't think that's an acceptable way for the federal government to be engaging on this issue in our province.
We spoke to the mayors of Calgary and Edmonton. Mm-hmm. You know, your two biggest cities facing enormous housing challenges, as you well know, and they are very worried about this for the uncertainty it creates. And in particular, the statement your government made the other day that about 800 of the existing agreements are problematic in your view. Like, does that mean you're going to go back and try to change deals, not renew them, tear them up?
No, we've made it pretty clear that this is on a go forward. And I think that Calgary and Edmonton, you know, good for them that they've got the political connections that allow them to get one-on-one bilateral deals. But guess what? I have to be prepared to make sure that 350 other municipalities are being treated fairly. We have 24 mid-sized cities that have been doubling and tripling in size. They need to have housing support as well. And so I just don't think that having the best lobbyist is the way that you should be getting money from the federal government. I think it should be fair.
Sean Fraser did announce housing agreements with smaller municipalities in Alberta. It wasn't just Edmonton and Calgary. I can't remember the precise number.
I can tell you. It was six.
It was six?
Worth $13.6 million. So by my calculation, with $175 million to Edmonton, $238 million going to Calgary, and $13.6 million to go to six cities, I would say that we're probably $1 to $2 billion behind where we are in other jurisdictions. And that's not fair.
So even if the federal government agrees to treat you the way they treat Quebec, as you're insisting, and sit down and negotiate with you on these agreements, there are still conditions on the money they've put on the table. For example, the $6 billion for municipal infrastructure in this budget, the $1 billion for urgent needs, and then the $5 billion that can go to the provinces if they agree to certain zoning changes across their jurisdiction, and if not, it goes to the provinces. Are you willing to meet those conditions to have that be an agreement between the provincial government and the federal government, or where does that lie?
Well, look, I mean, we'd have to negotiate. I know that Quebec often says, no, we don't want your conditions, but we will take your money, and they do often get agreements on that basis. I mean, so I guess what I object to is that they don't even begin the conversation in a matter of good faith, and they're continuing to interfere in provincial jurisdiction and announce things that I think that if you ask Calgarians right now about how they feel about the conditions that have been put on their cities, I mean, you've got the federal government essentially asking for a complete rewrite of the zoning regulations in Calgary and Edmonton as a condition for receiving money. I don't think it's a reasonable thing for the federal government to ask for, quite frankly.
But if the federal government, I mean, I'm sure if you were asked to put money into Calgary or Edmonton and you had specific policy objectives you had in mind, wouldn't you want to see conditions in order to get the money to achieve the policy goals you would have as a premier?
Well, I guess we have to make sure that we're putting policy in place that matches the needs of what our residents are asking us for. And that's what I would say is the important thing, is that these are Ottawa priorities, and I don't think that they're being very respectful of what it is that the local environment needs or wants. And I think that that's a real problem. This is the reason why, under our Constitution, there are certain things that have been assigned to the provinces to be to have a direct authority over. And it's because there are different mandates and different direction that each province needs to go in. And I think that needs to be respected.
This doesn't seem like it's just going to be a Justin Trudeau problem, though. Pierre Poilievre has put out that if municipalities don't meet housing targets, he's going to cut funding from infrastructure transfers to them, that they have to hit targets he is setting, or they're going to lose cash. How do you deal with Pierre Poilievre?
Well, look, I mean, I would hope that every federal leader would recognize that the Constitution matters and work with and through the provinces to be able to achieve shared outcomes. Look, we all share the desire to be able to ensure that more homes are being built, and there's lots of things that we can work on together to make sure that happens. Joint infrastructure projects, as well as increasing water, wastewater treatment grants, increasing transportation grants, and also working with developers to reduce red tape. I think that if we can find a way to sit down together, find those things that we can agree on, that'll be far better, to have the municipal, provincial, and federal governments working together. That's how our country is supposed to work.
It's not just municipal governments covered by this legislation you're proposing, though. Mm-hmm. It's also universities. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of concern from post-secondary researchers that this could give you a role, your government a role, the provincial government a role, in the distribution of research grants from the tri-national councils, the Medical Research Council, and CHIRC and SHRC. Is that what you're hoping to do here, or are those grants exempt from this sort of provincial involvement?
Well, look, I want to have a review. I don't know how many grants are coming and for what purpose, and if there's a need for us to use our own spending power to make sure that the broad range of research and opinion is taking place at universities so that there's a robust dialogue, as there should be at universities, then maybe we have to use our own research grants to make sure that we have that balance. I have been given enough indication that the federal federal government uses its power through researchers to only fund certain types of opinions, certain types of researchers. And I don't think that's fair either. I think we need to be able to have a balance in our university if we're going to have a robust, free, and democratic discussion about all issues.
But the National Research Councils are depoliticized, right? It's a jury of academics or peer-reviewed, and they make the decisions through application on research grants going to university, and it's all posted publicly, mm-hmm. so you can see what's there. But you don't have confidence in that system?
I have heard enough from some of our academics about how difficult it can be to be able to access some of that funding. So we just want to do a review, and we want to just see if there's some way that we can make sure that we maintain the environment at universities, which there should be, which is that all people from all political perspectives are able to engage in a robust debate and have a robust research agenda.
I can feel some researchers at the University of Calgary, the University of Alberta, and places in your province getting anxious with that, because, you know, the universities have agreements straight with these granting agencies. It's meant to be independent, to fund, you know, research that is protected by academic independence. What kind of a role do you see there for you?
I guess if we did truly have balance in universities, then we would see that we would have just as many conservative commentators as we do liberal commentators. Out of our journalism schools, we'd see just as many conservative-minded journalists graduate as we do progressive-minded journalists graduate. We don't see that. And so that leaves me to be concerned that we're not fostering the kind of environment that allows for balance, because we need to have balance. If we're going to have a balanced discussion in the broader public sphere, it begins at the universities.
I get that, but that would be an issue with campus culture, which is funded by provincial governments. This is like medical research and scientific research and humanities research that is not necessarily determining the makeup and composition of the people who work at a
particular
university.
You know, I guess we'll see. That's why we're doing the review. We want to see what kind of things are being funded. And if there are any areas that are problematic, we'll have to keep that in mind as funding agreements are renewed.
So, Premier, what if this leads to a situation where it becomes completely untenable with the federal government, and this billions of dollars that's on the table for infrastructure, they can't reach an agreement with you. You won't let it flow to the municipalities. And Albertans don't get their share of the money that's on the table to deal with these collective problems.
I don't anticipate that happening, because we did have a good relationship on the discussion around a healthcare deal. And we do have a good discussion about how we can support a variety of different private sector projects. They seem to be able to manage with the restrictions that Quebec has placed on them. And I would say that they shouldn't be engaging in asymmetric federalism. You can't have one particular way of dealing with one particular province and then shut another province out. So we're just asking them to abide by the Constitution, abide by the spirit of the way in which our country is supposed to work, and we'll see where it goes. I'm hopeful that it will actually start a new relationship with the federal government, and Albertans will get back at least a per capita share of what we're entitled to, because we are a substantial contributor to Confederation. We give more per capita to Confederation than we get back in federal programs and spending, and we just want to make sure that there's some fairness in the way those dollars come back.
So just as a final point, have you spoken to anyone from the federal government since you tabled this, or while you've been in Ottawa? I know you're here for the Canada Strong and Free Conference, which I don't think the Liberal government attended. Have you had any contact with anybody?
When I come to Ottawa, I always put in a call to see if I can meet with ministers. I did want to meet this time with Mark Miller. I always love to meet with François-Philippe Champagne. I've had a bit of a texting with him over the last couple of days, but no, we didn't have a chance to meet with anyone. I think that this on Fridays is when everyone gets sent home to their constituencies. But next time I'm up.
Okay. Premier Daniel Smith, always appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks
for joining us. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is having to clarify his position on a consumer price on carbon, because yesterday Singh said this in a speech at the Broadband Institute conference here in Ottawa.
Fighting the climate crisis can only be done if we are united. It can't be done by letting working people, by letting working families bear the cost of climate change while big polluters make bigger and bigger profits.
So after that speech, reporters asked Singh if he was saying he wants to get rid of the consumer carbon tax. Listen to this.
What we want to do is we want to lay out our vision, a new Democrat vision for how we tackle the climate crisis.
For the consumer price specifically, though, do you want to get rid of it? Do you want to pause it? Do you want to stop the hikes? Like, what are you proposing here?
For our full plan, we're going to release that plan and we're going to present that to Canadians. So we don't have our full plan laid out, but we have some elements, the principles of our plan. And the principles I want to lay out today were that I find it problematic that the Liberals have set up a divisive system where they're dividing the country.
Okay, so this morning the Prime Minister was asked about that, and he says he sympathizes with Singh due to all of the political pressures around the issue, but says that he no longer understands the NDP's position on climate change.
I don't entirely understand the position of the NDP in pulling back both from affordability measures and from the fight against climate change, but I can assure everyone that this government, my government, we'll continue to step up on the fight against climate change. We'll continue to put more money in families' pockets.
So hours later, Jagmeet Singh released this statement. New Democrats have not changed our position on the consumer carbon price. What we have done is commit to building a climate plan to make big polluters pay, bring down costs for Canadians, meet our emission targets, and unify people in taking on the climate crisis. It's time to bring in the Friday Power Panel to talk about all of that. Negan Sinclair is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. The CBC's Jason Markusoff is in Calgary. And here with me in Ottawa, editorial writer for Le Devoir, Marie Vastel, and the Toronto Star Ottawa Bureau Chief, Tonda McCharles. Tonda, where does this leave us? Because it sounded in that scrum yesterday that they were getting ready to move away from the carbon price. Mm-hmm. He says in the statement they haven't changed their plan, but it sounds like they're getting ready to develop a plan that maybe moves away from the
carbon
price.
Here's the problem. It wasn't just that scrum. It was earlier this week, midweek, the NDP supported a conservative motion for the First Minister's Conference on a carbon tax debate, which all of the premiers, most of the premiers at least, want to get rid of, if not get rid of, exempt them, their own provinces from, including an NDP premier. And so they support the Conservatives on that. They can't explain it later. Then they say they blame the Liberals for thinking a consumer carbon price is the quote-unquote be-all and end-all. So that suggests that they're not too enamored of it anymore. And look, the NDP is squeezed politically. Whether we understand what exactly they're saying right now, what we do understand is the politics. Right? Mm. They're being squeezed by Conservatives in blue-collar ridings where the NDP vote is at risk. They're getting squeezed by voters who actually support climate action and think that the Liberal consumer carbon price is a part of that. But they also have NDP government or parties, rather, in Alberta and Saskatchewan who oppose it. And again, Wab Kanu in Manitoba is the premier who wants out of the carbon tax plan. So, look, politically he's getting squeezed. And so he's trying to come up with a policy solution that threads the needle. And up until late this afternoon, could not say, in his own words, I support a consumer carbon price.
Well, he's not.
Well,
he's not
I still don't think they're there, right?
Not quite there.
Yeah, yeah. So Marie, it sounds like they're like the New Democrats I've been speaking with about it are saying if people have to choose between affordability and climate, affordability is going to win and climate is going to lose, and we need to find a new way forward to ease those concerns. Mm-hmm. But that sounds like no consumer carbon price.
Straight up told everything's on the table.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, I think they are slowly setting the stage for what we deciphered from his speech, and he didn't communicate that clearly.
At minimum, that was a trial balloon, or most likely it was a step away from supporting carbon price.
I think he's really preparing things for his big new climate plan to shift. It's not, the points that he raises aren't a wrong debate or an erroneous debate. Even environmentalists will say, are there more effective ways? Are there different ways of fighting pollution? The Climate Institute, which is not exactly a right-wing group, came out with a report recently saying that industrial pricing will bring down between now and 2030 emissions by 20 to 48%. But consumer pricing is like 8 to 14%, so less effective.
Right, but people aren't smelters, right? Like, industry is where most of the emissions come from.
Yeah. I'm just saying there is a debate to be had, even amongst environmentalists. People say there might be different policies.
Sure.
But it's a complete 180 for the NDP to say, not we propose this and this and this on top of the existing carbon pricing, but instead. It's not unusual for the NDP to be talking about affordability. Jack Layton in 2010 asked for the GST to be cut from
home heating.
But he was also asking for retrofit measures, and you can ask for public transport measures or car incentive. You could ask for other things. And I agree with Tonda. What we clearly see is Mr. Singh sort of struggling to see where to position himself. But the communicating is off. The timing is very odd when a quarter of their caucus had just said they're not running again. It just gives the impression of this party that's struggling and sort of trying to figure out where they fit in. And it opens a huge pathway for Liberals, in my mind, because they're the sort of natural alternative in people's minds. It's harder for the NDP to convince people to vote for them. Now it's even harder amongst progressives.
Right. Well, Nigan, you know, you're in Manitoba, right, where Wab Kanoo is sort of a proposing a similar sort of thing. Most of the NDP caucus is in British Columbia, where they've had a consumer carbon price without as robust a rebate system as the feds have for longer than the federal government has had it. What do you make of this? Just saying, yeah, we're reconsidering whether the carbon price fits into our plan provides more clarity than all of the statements and comments we've actually gotten.
Well, the Manitoba pulling out of the consumer carbon, or the request to pull out, has to do more with the net zero fact that Manitoba is heading towards a net zero, and that they feel that it's redundant and that it doesn't have the kind of impactual nature for Manitobans. And of course, the issue is if that's true or not. But I mean, the fact that Singh is coming out and talking about the Canadian Climate Institute's report, I've been on record on this show to say that consumer pricing doesn't have the same kind of impact as industrial pricing, but that both is probably needed on some level. And the reality is that I think that this kind of vagueness or this ability that Singh has to sort of try to play both cards, but really downplay what is a very unpopular consumer carbon price, and then gives the Liberals a real space to distance themselves and to sort of position themselves as the ones who bring in the consumer pricing index. And the reality is that that's really what the Liberals have wanted for a while. They've wanted to be seen as kind of a champion on this issue. I don't know if Canadians will be able to see that. I think certainly that the NDP, unless they come out with a plan that involves both, if they decide to go all industrial and to play the big polluter model, which is what Singh's been doing for the past 24 hours of saying big polluter, big polluter, big polluter, I'm not sure that Canadians will be or have a kind of understanding of what that means other than the constant kind of call that they do for making big, I mean, instead of saying big polluter, say big corporate entity, say big tax evader. I mean, that's a frequent NDP that people just get tuned out. And so I'm not sure that this is a very logical move by Singh to be able to try to gain support and really try to shore up what is a major loss in ridings on the issue of affordability to the Conservatives on this one issue alone.
So Jason, I was reading about the potential for the differentiation between the Liberals and the NDP in this boutique newspaper called the Toronto Star. I think Tonda might have had a byline on that or files from. But it seems, you know, where this argument is going, that the federal Liberals and the Greens, of course, would be the last party standing, a federal party standing by consumer carbon pricing. And should the election go the way it looks like it's going to go now, and the provinces would be left to their own devices in many, many ways, we're going to go back to this sort of patchwork quilt of approaches to dealing with this issue of different levels of ambition in different jurisdictions. And it is difficult to see a path where the targets are hit under such a scenario.
Well, I can't imagine anybody is going to want to run in defense of this carbon tax that isn't completely chained to it.
Yeah.
You can argue that the NDP are, but you know, this wasn't their election promise. This is something they wound up going along with in minority government settings. They could point to the fact that the first party that ran vociferously against a consumer carbon tax was the New Democrats in BC. They fought tooth and nail against the Gordon Campbell Liberals' carbon tax more than a decade ago and lost. And of course, the current BC NDP, is now, is one of the last major governmental parties defending this current approach right now. It's not surprising that Jagmeet Singh wants to defend, clear distance from a deeply unpopular policy. But I think there's also the reality in his own, among his own voter set, that they want to make sure that they have a credible policy. There are, even though, to Marie's point, excellent point about the Canadian Climate Institute report, that's still some percentages and still some megatons to make up, be it by stronger industrial policies or something else. And if anybody in the NDP or elsewhere don't think that those costs ultimately get passed on to the consumer, I have a few economic textbooks to send you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, going back to that Climate Institute report, I mean, the 8 to 10% that this represents, Tonda, it's the emissions of Manitoba on an annual basis for three of the Atlantic provinces.
Yeah. So that's what surprises me. On the one hand, that Jagmeet Singh cited that report in saying that, look, industrial emitters are the bigger polluter here and where we need to put our focus. Well, duh. But what do you do with
the other one?
What do you do with the other thing? It's not an either or. It's not a binary choice. Yeah. At least it hasn't been for that party up until I guess, a couple of weeks ago when they voted in favor of the increase to the federal carbon tax, right?
Yeah.
So I guess to me it was this the incoherence of the last 48 hours, 72 hours of the NDP's stance on this speaks to a bigger political problem for them, and that's what fascinates me. And, you know, for now today that they are saying, even only on background to people like us saying, we actually do support the consumer carbon price. It makes me wonder, what are you setting the stage for?
Yeah.
Where are you going with it? And so,
is
the plan? It's one thing to float a trial balloon and say we're going to focus on double down on industrial emitters. I think that's
but that doesn't sound like that doesn't sound like what it is the problem.
No, it
right?
doesn't.
Yeah.
So just run out of time, but Marie, you know, if the goal here is to draw a contrast, right, to separate themselves from the liberal policy, but also be distinct from the conservative policy. In politics in 2024, there's axe the tax and you get a rebate. You get back more than you pay. I don't know if there's room in the argument in between that for some fuzzy third way, unless it's explicitly clear. And that's not what we've seen.
Well, and especially from the NDP was my point, because they all we've seen in the polls, the Liberals going down, the Conservatives going up. The NDP is not gaining anything from this dynamic. They're like staying or even going down a little bit. So they're not doing excessively well. And they have a bigger hill to climb to convince people to vote for them, especially if there is an indication that the Conservatives are going to win the election and some people would like to block that. Their usual reflex is to vote Liberal. So they have this bigger convincing to do, and now they're sort of taking away one of their own arguments to distinguish themselves from the Conservatives. It just seems like they're really shooting themselves in the foot. And what I found really interesting was that all this happened from Jagmeet Singh, when then you had Boris Johnson come talk to the Canada Strong and Free Conference network, anyway, I can't say it, that thing, and say, Mr. Johnson saying to Conservatives, you need an environmental plan.
Yeah.
You cannot not have one. It was almost like they were each at their own conference. Anyway, to me, it was quite interesting to see the contrast.
Yeah, Nigam, a quick final 60 seconds from you, but it is interesting because this comes from Jagmeet Singh, not in an off-the-cuff thing in a scrum, but from a scripted text
to the
Broadbent Institute, right?
I mean, almost immediately after making a huge tribute to Ed Broadbent, he came out and then made this announcement, which, while vague, still gestured to the idea that there's some sort of plan coming, and then constantly said, there's a plan coming, there's a plan coming, there's a plan coming. Well, that plan had better be specific, and it had better, if it is going to thread the needle, as Tana pointed out, it needs to be specifically about industrial emitters and have some kind of radical way that can differentiate itself, because if they're putting all chips in the middle on this one, this is a really big risk.
I think what would be really good before the election, just as a final point for me, is if everybody put their climate plans out there and the PBO could compare them all, and we'd get an apples-to-apples PBO analysis of everybody's measures so we could have a proper election campaign on. It would be fun.
You fantasize.
I know. I'm a nerd. I know. I'm hopelessly naive. All right. I want to thank the power panel, Jason Markusoff, Nigam Sinclair, Tanda McCharles, and Marie Vestal. Thanks so much, gang. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.